Inside Florida Politics, the essential podcast powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, coming to you from West Palm Beach, Florida. And returning to the podcast after 1 week absence is Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson.
Hey, George, rested and ready to go.
And normally we're joined from Tallahassee by John Kennedy, the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief, but John is on assignment this week. However, filling in, we have perhaps the most distinguished guest we've ever had on the podcast, multiple award-winning Palm Beach Post investigative reporter Pat Beal.
Hi, George.
All right. Well, after the 22-month Mueller investigation, multiple congressional hearings, and years of cable TV blathering, you might think you've heard enough about President Donald Trump and Russia, but you haven't until you've heard the inevitable Florida angle. And our special guest, Pat Beal, is going to talk about, she used her ace reporting skills to focus on the many Florida connections to the Trump-Russia story. And the result is this fascinating six-episode podcast that doesn't pontificate about collusion or witch hunts and really doesn't include much politics at all, just some compelling storytelling about a few of the interesting Russians who have come into Trump's orbit here in Florida. So we will talk about that on the podcast. Also, Zach Anderson caught up with indicted Florida man Roger Stone, who recently made an appearance in Sarasota. There's a federal judge's gag order that prevents Stone from talking about his pending case, but he still found a lot to talk about, and Zach will fill us in on that. And then finally, Joe Biden is on his way to Florida for the first time as a declared 2020 presidential candidate. He's got a big lead over his many Democratic rivals in national and statewide polls. Will that hold for him? We will talk about that. But first, I believe I'm hearing some kind of funky royalty-free music playing. And listeners of the podcast know when you hear that music, it means it's time for our pick a number segment. That's the portion of the podcast where each of us puts forward a number. And then later on, we explain what that number means in Florida politics. Zach Anderson, are you ready with a number for us?
I sure am, George. I'm going to throw out a 14 today.
All right. Note takers, write down a 14 for Zach Anderson in Sarasota. Pat Beal, new to the podcast, but have you come prepared with a number?
I have. 450, 312, 500 million.
Wow. Biggest number ever, I think, we've had. 450.
312. Mm-hmm. 500.
Wow. Okay. Like 450 million
yeah.
some. Okay. That's a, all right. Wow. That's what happens when you have a special guest on. and my number, George Bennett, is 200. So if you're keeping notes, and which we encourage, lowest to highest, Zach Anderson is 14, George Bennett, 200, and Pat Beal busting the podcast with a 450,312,500. You want to remember those numbers, and at the end of the podcast, we will explain what they mean in Florida politics. But let's get straight to our loaded lineup. As I mentioned in the introduction, you might think you've heard a lot about Donald Trump and Russia. But when I listen to this new series that Pat Beal put together, along with the accordion accompaniment and general wisecrackery of Palm Beach Post columnist Frank Cherubino, I was fascinated by the stories that she weaves together about some of these Russian characters who have intersected with Donald Trump here in Florida. And what's unique about the series is it's really, and this is a politics podcast, but it's really not a very political series at all. And it doesn't Pat doesn't present it as, you know, some kind of prosecutor's brief or draw some kind of grandiose conclusions from it. It's just interesting stories like you'd tell around the campfire, just some interesting stuff. So as always, we always introduce our guests on the podcast with the royalty free surf music. But But Pat actually comes with her own music. Let's cue the Frank Cherubino accordion music as well, please. Now, here on this podcast, we always have we rely on a royalty-free library of music, but for Pat's series, no expense was spared, and they have their own original music. That's Frank Cherubino, Palm Beach Post columnist, playing the accordion. Pat, tell us about this series. First of all, the series is called The Dancing Oligarchs. Where did that title come from?
It actually came from a paragraph in the Palm Beach Post from many years ago, where there was a wedding at Mar-a-Lago, and Donald Trump was the MC. And it was reported in our paragraph and our social reporting that there were 600 dancing oligarchs that night. Now, you know, probably not all were oligarchs, probably oligarchs in training, people who might have, should have been oligarchs, but you get the feel for it.
Wow. Okay. And so that was one example that is talked about in this series of Russians intersecting with Donald Trump in his days before politics as a businessman and man about Palm Beach. There were a lot of these connections.
Oh, there were so many. And as you said, I mean, it's not about the politics. For one thing, and I say this over and over again as many times as I can, there is nothing inherently wrong with doing business with Russians or Russian money, even sketchy Russians, because whether it toes the legal line or not is about the deal. And we didn't want to look at the deals. We just wanted to look at the people.
Right. And it's interesting, folks. Now mention, there's one guy, I can't really pronounce his name very well, Dmitry Rybolovlev, that we're going to talk about. But who, just run us through just briefly a couple of the characters that appear in the podcast series.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I think probably the best known is Felix Sater. He did show up in the Mueller report, and he's a pretty colorful guy. He said that, you know, he was a real estate dealer by day and hunting bin Laden by night. He had a very interesting relationship with the Department of Justice. And, of course, he wound up in South Florida because, as we all know, everything's strange. Winds up in South Florida, right? Yeah. So there was Felix. There was Sam Kislin, who had a electronic store, before he became a billionaire. And he got ripped off twice in deals involving frozen Russian chicken legs, which also wound up in Florida again. We come to Florida.
Frozen Russian chicken legs wind up in Florida. That's in which? That's in one of the first one or two episodes of the.
That would be the first episode.
Okay.
Father of the Bride.
If that's not enough of a teaser to get you listening, the frozen Russian chicken legs. But the one guy that I wanted to talk a little more in depth about because this is a case this was big news here in Palm Beach and elsewhere back in more than 10 years ago. Donald Trump bought a big mansion up the street from Mar-a-Lago in the north end of Palm Beach for $41 million in around, 2004, maybe?
I think it may have been a few years after that, but the mid-2000s.
Okay. So and this is, long before Trump was was running for president. He bought this mansion and then turned around and sold it for the asking price was $100 million.
Right.
And I think he sold it for what?
95 million.
Okay. And who did he sell it to?
Well, he sold it to Dmitry Rybolovlev, whose name I probably will never be able to correctly pronounce. So we're going to call him Dmitry for the purposes of this podcast.
Okay.
And Dmitry had been a doctor in Russia when the USSR started falling apart. He was only about 21 years old. And when Russia started falling apart, the assets of the country were pretty much up for grabs. And that was the rise of the oligarchs. And pretty soon, Dmitry was at the top of a multi-billion-dollar potash company. And he was a genuine bona fide oligarch.
Potash, of course, is...
Potash is a form of fertilizer, and nothing grows really well without fertilizer. It's just one of those things you don't think about, but you really, really need.
Okay, so Dmitry, with the name I won't attempt again, but so right. he basically overpaid. Even at the time, I think there was why is this guy paying this much?
Yeah, he overpaid by about $38 million. And, according to property records, if you go by the property records. And at the time, I recall the sale and I was thinking, Russian oligarchs, they just throw money around like whatever because they have so much money.
Right.
And in fact, there was speculation, especially about Dmitry. I think it was once said that, he spent money like a drunk sailor. So, he overpaid. And our ace real estate reporter, Alex Clow, really dug into that sale both then and since then. It's great reading what you just looked at in terms
Google it, Alex Clow, C-L-O-U-G-H. Use the Google. That's what the kids are using, I understand. But yeah.
The great Google brain.
And
yes.
So I want to play a clip from the podcast. This from Pat's podcast, The Dancing Oligarchs. This is part of the podcast. Frank Cherubino and Pat talking about some of the speculation as to why Mr. Rybolovlev might have overpaid for this mansion.
So, okay. So why did he pay so much?
There are a couple of possible explanations. One, he was hiding money before his divorce by overpaying. That's what his wife said in divorce papers. Hiding money in that divorce would make a lot of sense because not so long after the mansion buy, she got a $4.6 billion, with a B, settlement, the largest divorce in the world, if not the known universe.
Well, better to give it to Trump than the ex-wife, right? What's your other explanation, though?
That Dmitry was hiding money from the Kremlin. That's what he hinted at in divorce papers. And that would make a lot of sense, too, if, as has been frequently suggested, Vladimir Putin was shaking down oligarchs for a piece of the action, making Vlad the most efficient shakedown artist in the world, if not the known universe.
Yeah, hiding it from Vlad. I like that explanation better.
Okay, now, first of all, I have accordion envy right now. Why don't on our podcast we've been doing, why can't we have some background accordion music when we're talking? But okay, so that's Pat and Frank talking about some of the speculation as to why this guy might have overpaid for this mansion. But then let's continue with this other clip, though. The other thing, though, is this was a significant deal for Donald Trump at the time. And I think this clip that we're going to play explains that.
In any event, Dmitry changed his mind about liking the Trump mansion. And because he did, Trump got a windfall profit just when he needed it most.
Yeah, I remember that. The year was 2008, and that was a rough one for Trump.
That's right. The market wasn't only cratering in Florida. The year of the sale, Trump was personally on the hook for $40 million after sales started slumping at a Chicago tower project. He was late on payments, and the bank wanted its $40 million.
I guess you could say that Trump needed to grow some money, and a Russian fertilizer billionaire came along.
No, Frank, you could say that. Dmitry's millions gave Trump enough to pay off a $20 million mortgage and still have enough to pay most of the $40 million to help resolve that pesky Chicago problem. He didn't use the money to pay the bank, though. Instead, he sued the bank for $3 billion, saying the real estate recession that kept him from paying his bills was the equivalent of an act of God beyond anyone's control.
That's a good one.
Accordion.
But I can't help but commenting. Commentary is just an act of God.
All right. There's a little flavor of the Dancing Oligarchs podcast. Now, here's the question I have, Pat. Whatever was behind, this deal, clearly this was going on long before. I know the Russians might play the long game, but clearly nobody thought Donald Trump was going to be president when this was going on. But what's the significance of it, you think?
Well, I think the speculation when Donald Trump did begin running for president and after his election, when there were, everybody was thinking, connections between Russians and Donald Trump, was that Dmitry had been laundering money by overpaying for real estate, is a time-honored way of laundering money. And that might have made him, the speculation went, you know, somehow indebted to Dmitry. You know, so part of it was speculation. Part of it was the fact that when Trump began running for president, Dmitry's plane kept lighting down on runways where Trump was. And that was really odd because we've looked at flight records, and really most of the time leading up to that, Dmitry had been going to, I don't know, Beijing and Switzerland and London and Marseille and Nice, you know, but not so much Concord, North Carolina.
Wow. Yeah, I do recall that. It's never been established that he and Trump ever interacted with each other.
No, there's nothing to suggest. Well, let me back up. Donald Trump says he has never met Ryabalolov, Dmitry. And Dmitry, through a spokesman, told John Pacenti here at the Post that, you know, the plane landings were a coincidence. And they could have been.
Yeah, just a guy going from Marseille to Milwaukee and whatever. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but that includes it. And I have to tell you, one of the places he put down was Duluth, Minnesota. No, Duluth, North Dakota.
Okay.
And we called Duluth because we thought that was really kind of interesting for him. And basically, they just said, you know, what is wrong with you people? You know, what is wrong with you people? So what if a Russian oligarch puts down here and shoot us away? So
there you go. Okay. So what does that all add up to? Who knows? But it's a very interesting story. And this podcast, The Dancing Oligarchs, it's 6 episodes. It's a good binge listen. And you know, it just gives you some interesting detail and texture to this whole Trump-Russia thing with the inevitable Florida angle. So be sure to check that out. Well, moving more to domestic politics, Roger Stone, the longtime friend and advisor of President Donald Trump, was in Sarasota. Zach Anderson, tell us what Roger Stone was talking about, because he couldn't talk about his indictment. He's scheduled to go to trial, I believe, in November on some charges, but he couldn't talk about that. What did he talk about?
Yeah, Roger Stone is limited in what he can say, but he still found plenty to talk about. You know, he was indicted by special counsel Robert Mueller and accused of lying to Congress when they questioned him about his involvement with the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks, other activities. And he's pleaded not guilty, and he says he needs to raise about $2 million for his defense fund. So he's been traveling around the country giving speeches. He was actually at a strip club earlier, and he made an appearance with a woman who is known as the Manhattan Madam. So he's been raising some money in some interesting places. In Sarasota, he appeared at a beer distributor, and it was with the group that was Women for Trump Sarasota Manatee hosted him. So, you know, they brought him in and they were charging $50 a ticket or $75 for VIP tickets. And he's, you know, he basically was talking about politics, and he really got into an issue that has really riled conservatives recently, this allegations of censorship by media companies, especially social media companies. Earlier this month, Facebook banned a bunch of far right media figures, including InfoWars founder Alex Jones. And critics say, you know, these individuals are spreading lies and stoking dangerous extremist views. But Stone argues that the silencing of these voices represents the greatest threat to Donald Trump. I think we have a clip of him.
The president, instead of monitoring the situation, should direct his Justice Department to enact immediate antitrust action against Google, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, et al. This is the single most important issue facing us, because essentially they're taking away the president's megaphone. They're taking away our ability to amplify what he says. They're taking away the platform with which he can counterpunch. And he is the greatest counterpuncher in American political history.
Stone earlier made the point that 2016 was the year that basically the mainstream media lost control of the political narrative. in America, and basically that alternative media is really ascendant. And that's certainly true. Trump's rise was really aided by InfoWars and other alternative media sources. So if these organizations have less of a reach through social media in the 2020 campaign, I think that could be significant. And we've seen the president and the White House lash out against some of these tech companies. And it's really interesting, though, that they've been getting criticized from the left as well. And Facebook's co-founder actually came out and said recently that he thinks Facebook should be broken up and that they have too much control over the speech of 2 billion people. So, you know, the social media companies are really being barraged from all sides here. And Roger Stone is just part of that. He kind of bragged a little bit that he was a pioneer in getting banned from Twitter 2 years ago. And Stone was also asked a few times about Mueller and other issues related to his case, and he mostly demurred. But he did defend Julian Assange at one point.
Julian Assange has done what journalists do. He has gotten and vetted and published information that embarrasses the government, just like the New York Times, just like the Washington Post, just like the Wall Street Journal. That's what journalists do. Daniel Ellsberg stole the Pentagon Papers, classified information regarding the origins of the Vietnam War, and we hold him up to be a hero. Beyond that, I'm going to duck your question.
So there you go, George. Julian Assange, he's just like you and I.
Or just like Daniel Ellsberg. So interesting. Okay. Well, Roger Stone never fails to make headlines. And let me ask you this. The reason that he's out going to strip clubs and beer distributors and other venues is to raise money for his legal defense. And you mentioned what they were charging, $50 and $75 a head. What was your did you get a sense of whether he was able to raise much money at this event you attended?
It's hard to say, but, you know, there was maybe 100 people, maybe a little bit less. I think some of those people were part of his entourage and some of the people probably didn't pay to get in. So, you know, being generous and saying that there was 100 people, each of them, you know, paying $75 for the VIP ticket that gets you a signed book and a picture with him, that would be $7,500. I think he probably raised well less than that, but even if it was $7,500, he would have to do 266 of these events to raise the $2 million that he says he needs for his legal defense fund. So we'll see. It doesn't seem like he was raising all that much money at this event. He was also selling black T-shirts with white lettering that read "Roger Stone did nothing wrong" on them, and it seems like he's been trying every avenue he can to raise money here.
How much is one of those T-shirts?
That's a good question. I do not know, but they did seem to be attracting some interest. I saw a number of people wearing them.
I have seen one person wear one of those in public over here in Palm Beach County. So there, yeah, I should have asked what they sold for. Okay. So, well, there you go. The Roger Stone legal defense. He's scheduled to go to trial, I believe, in November.
He's not pleading guilty. You know, he's not changing his plea. He's going to fight it all the way to the end. And somebody asked him, if he still communicates with Trump. And he said, no, he doesn't, that their lawyers have advised them not to. But he noted that Trump has tweeted sympathetically about him multiple times. And I asked him in an earlier interview if he's asked Trump for a pardon, and he says that he hasn't. But there is some speculation here that he's going to the mat and expecting a pardon potentially.
We will see what happens with that. Well, the last item we wanted to get to on the podcast, Joe Biden is coming to Florida for the first time as a declared 2020 presidential candidate. He will be doing fundraisers Monday, I believe, in Miami, and then Tuesday up near Orlando at the home of trial lawyer John Morgan. As he comes to Florida, and we talked a few weeks ago about the Democratic fundraising from Florida, the presidential candidates had really not raised a ton of money here. And conventional wisdom was that the donors were kind of on the fence waiting to see whether Biden would get in the race. Well, now he is, and he is going to scoop up some of that money at these fundraisers. And obviously, it is very early. I mean, ask President Rudy Giuliani about having an early big lead in Florida. But there was a poll in the past week that showed Biden up among Democrats with 39% of the vote. Bernie Sanders a distant second at 16, and everybody else in single digits. And I think maybe 28% undecided. There's two things. Zach, I want to get your take on this. So on the one hand, Florida definitely has a history in presidential primaries when they've been contested, Democratic races, of going for the familiar establishment candidate. Back in 2008, when Barack Obama was this kind of insurgent guy, Florida, Hillary Clinton won Florida by like 17 points. And then in 2016, when Bernie Sanders was getting some traction as with his anti-establishment message in the Democratic Party, Hillary crushed him here like 64 to 33 or something. So this is a state that, you know, tends to favor kind of establishment familiar candidates. On the other hand, we saw in last year's Democratic governor's primary, when it was a crowded race, the more conventional establishment pick might have been Gwen Graham. But in that race, arguably the most liberal candidate of all, Andrew Gillum, won. I think he got 33 or 34% in the five-way primary. So Zach Anderson, from your experience, how do you see the Florida presidential primary shaping up?
Well, I think Biden's early lead is fascinating, and I think it does show that despite all this talk about the ascendancy of the progressive wing of the party and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie, all the attention to Bernie Sanders in 2016 and even Andrew Gillum, that there still is a huge chunk of the Democratic Party that seems to be more comfortable with sort of these establishment, a little bit less of a firebrand type figures. As you noted, George, Gillum won with just over 30% of the vote. If it had been a head-to-head matchup, who knows what would have happened? If it had been, Gillum as Bernie versus Gwen Graham as Hillary or something like that, and just two people, I really wonder if he would have pulled it out. Who knows? But I still think, that there are a lot of Democrats who are a little bit more middle of the road, might not be fully comfortable with Medicare for all or the Green New Deal, might support it, but, they're not necessarily, supportive of huge tax increases or other things once the rubber hits the road, talking about paying for this. And so I think maybe Democrats are rethinking a little bit, what would be the best candidate to take on Trump as well. Biden, he's not policy wise. He's not a real progressive. He supported tough on crime legislation. He oversaw very aggressive questioning of Anita Hill during the Clarence Thomas hearing, which is sort of at odds with the current Me Too movement. And he's an old white guy in a party that values youth and diversity. But I wonder if some people sort of think maybe an old white guy has the best chance of beating another old white guy, and maybe that he would play well in Michigan and Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania. And so I wonder if maybe there's a calculation here that he just has the best chance of winning.
Yeah, that could be the case. And, the big there's I think the estimate now is there's about two dozen Democrats that are running for president right now. By the time Florida's primary runs around, it comes around, it's in March 17th, I believe, next year. It will be after a lot of primaries, including like California and Texas. So the field will be a lot smaller. And so we'll see who's still standing by the time Florida comes around. But there you go. Right now, the early snapshot, Joe Biden way ahead in among Florida Democrats and coming into the state to raise money. Well, I think I'm hearing that funky royalty-free music again. So let's get back to that pick a number segment. Pat, that enormous number, 450,312,500. What's the story behind that?
Well, that was the amount of money that we think Dimitri got when he sold what is probably a Da Vinci to a Dubai prince, the most expensive painting ever sold. The Dubai prince was probably acting on behalf of the Saudi crown prince tied to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And the painting has disappeared now. I think it's probably going to wind up in Florida.
Yeah, a Da Vinci.
Maybe a Da Vinci. A little controversy.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, a little controversy. If you're spending $450 million, you better be pretty sure it's a Da Vinci. Wow, okay. But Pat, having Pat has really elevated this podcast. I mean, we're talking about Da Vinci and the accordion music and just wow. Okay. Well, let's continue. We'll go highest to lowest after that huge number. My number was 200. 200 as or 200 million. 200, that's the amount of dollars that President Donald Trump now supports for Everglades restoration in the upcoming budget year. And that is the amount that Governor Ron DeSantis and Senators Marco Rubio and Rick Scott, all Republicans, urged the president to support earlier this year. But the president's budget instead called for only $63 million for Everglades restoration. That was a number that the Republicans responded, they criticized as being, quote, incredibly short-sighted, close quote. So when Trump came, you remember at the end of March, he came to visit Lake Okeechobee. There was some speculation that, you know, maybe he would announce that he was going to agree with the Republican leaders in the state and support this $200 million figure. He did not. Instead, he mostly talked about the wall with Mexico. But now he has finally come around to saying he supports $200 million. And it's a rare moment of bipartisan agreement in the state. Democrats in, as well as Republicans in Florida have always, you know, supported more money for Everglades restoration. Congress appropriates money. And, the question is whether the legislators in the other 49 states are going to want to go along with that. It's worth noting that since 2000, the average annual appropriation that Congress has approved, whether Democrats or Republicans have been in charge, the average appropriation for Everglades restoration has been around $76 million. So the president and the leaders of Florida are asking for basically nearly a tripling of what has historically been spent on Everglades restoration. We'll see how that plays out. Last number we had, 14, Zach Anderson.
George, 14 is the number of votes needed to be Florida House Speaker in 2024. That's right, 2024. And it's kind of crazy that we're talking about who's going to be Florida House Speaker in 2024, but that's going to be decided in just a few weeks. There's 27 Republicans in the freshman class of the Florida House. And so to win, the speakership, you have to get 14 votes, a majority of votes, and they start picking their speakers years and years in advance. The incoming class of freshmen will pick their speaker this summer, and that person will be sort of the speaker designate all the way until 2024. And they have an enormous amount of power because people know that they're going to be speaker someday. And one of the reasons that I'm interested in it particularly is because there's a Republican from this area, Will Robinson, who has been running. And he apparently is maybe a few votes behind Danny Perez, a Republican from the Miami area. And there's a little bit of intrigue because Robinson hasn't been able to lock up support from even everybody in the local delegation, which has caused a lot of friction in this area. So we'll see how it plays out. Apparently, the race is very tight, but Perez has the advantage right now.
So if you're a Republican thinking about running for a House seat, you want to call Mr. Perez or Mr. Robinson and have them come raise money for you and try to curry favor. But, okay, interesting number. Well, that wraps up another one of our Inside Florida Politics podcasts. I am Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett. As always, it has been my honor to host the show with these fine journalists. I've been joined here in West Palm Beach by Pat Beal of the Palm Beach Post and by Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson. John Kennedy, the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau chief, is on assignment, but he should be back next week. I've been assisted here in West Palm Beach by Corzano. That's the team of Thomas Cordy and Joe Forzano, queuing up those sound clips and music. And as always, the man behind the curtain in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, the digital audio production director for Gatehouse Media, Adam Fish. Thank you.